designers and curious minds. Ever wondered about the stories hiding within your building's walls? I'm Carrie Seaburn, structural engineer and host of Unstruct, the podcast that decodes and simplifies major concepts of structural design. Behind the math and physics, structural engineering simply predicts building behavior. Join me as we simplify the complex, making structural design accessible to everyone.
Nowadays, instead of measuring it via cost, we're saying, well, what about carbon, you know? We've got two levers now that we can, if an architect has an inefficient design, we can hit them with two levers, if you like.
The official casualty figure is 55,000. Everybody I talked to told me that the actual figure is at least three times as much. And I believe that. I mean, seeing what I saw, Turkish codes are good, and they have been improving, but compliance was completely lacking.
Fluent in steel, concrete, masonry, and timber design, I'll bring you leading engineers to dissect the tales behind their building structure. Whether you're an architect, contractor, engineer, or just love a good story, this podcast is for you.
Yeah, beam penetrations. That's a fun topic on this project.
Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Unstruct. From within your walls, hear the story behind how your building stands today.
My name is Mark R. LePage, and you are listening to Entree Architect Podcast, where each week I speak with inspiring, passionate people who share their knowledge and expertise, all to help you build a better business as a small firm entrepreneur architect. Today, I'm joined by Annette Reidenauer, a pioneer in the design of healing environments and the founder of Aesthetics Incorporated. Over more than four decades, Annette has helped healthcare organizations use art, interiors, wayfinding, and community engagement to create spaces that support patients, families, and caregivers. Her work offers small firm architects an important reminder that design does more than solve functional problems. It shapes how people feel, connect, and heal. Today, we're going to explore how whole person evidence-based design can create more of a meaningful human experience. Annette Reidenauer, welcome to Entree Architect Podcast.
I'm so happy to be here.
I'm happy to have you here. We had a conversation offline. Well, not really offline. I guess it was online, but off air a few weeks ago. And you were sharing what you did and your story. I'm like, oh, I can't wait to share this with the podcast. It's such an interesting thing that you do and the organization that you built. And so I'm looking forward to sharing that with our community here. But before we do that, I want to know more about you personally. When did you discover your passion for what you do, and who or what inspired you to get there?
Well, I discovered my passion basically in the early 80s. My firm, Aesthetics, was founded in 1980. And a lot of the inspiration came from sharing my mother's cancer journey in the 70s and early 80s. She, as many, you know, had breast cancer and went on a healthcare journey. And I was the person, the companion, you know, for this. Mm-hmm. And at that particular point in time, a lot of hospitals and clinics were designed to be clinically clean with a lot of green. And the emphasis was really on no bacteria and not really anything having to do with aesthetics. So two things happened. I was a gallerist in the 70s, and an architect walked into my gallery one day, and it was a very large community gallery, 10,000 square feet. So I had artists of all media.
Wow. Where was the gallery?
In La Jolla, California.
Okay.
And he laid some blueprints on the counter and said he was building a hospital and wanted to see if I was interested in doing an art program. So at that point, I said, what is an art program? I had no knowledge whatsoever. And he's, you know, so he said, well, we have to put art in, you know, in this environment. And I'm sure you could figure it out with all the artists that you have. And so I convened a group of 12 artists that I thought were very, very talented. And we sat down, had several meetings on what could we do for a healthcare environment that would affect the emotional experience of patients and visitors? And so we asked our families, we asked friends, and we decided at that particular point that, you know, things that resonated with nature and positivity. And so we didn't really know what we were doing, so we commissioned original art for every single piece. I mean, artists were making $50 a piece of art, but everybody was just so excited about it. So that was very transforming for me. And then, unfortunately, my mother's journey worsened quickly. And, you know, I sat on her deathbed, and the room was so sterile. Mm-hmm. I mean, I remember the only thing that she had to look at was a flickering fluorescent light. And at that point, I said, I have to do something about this. I didn't know how I was going to do it, but it really felt like, you know, I could do something. And that was my inspiration.
Was your mother's experience before or after the architect visiting you at the gallery?
Actually, after.
So you had that experience with the architect and using the artists, and then your mom and her experience. And I remember some hospitals like that growing up and how sterile they were. And, you know, they were not places where people wanted to be or not very conducive to feeling well. And so I could imagine how inspired you were sitting there and you experiencing it and your mom experiencing it. When did you make the connection that there was something there more for you?
Well, I was so inspired. And, you know, the gallery ran into some challenges. I was owning it with my husband at the time, which was not working out. So we decided to sell the gallery, and I wanted to open aesthetics and start a new life. And aesthetics was designed for that purpose, to work with healthcare institutions. So it was just a natural next move for me. And at that particular point in time, in 1980, there was no literature. There was no place to search. You know, there was no Google, you know, no computers, 1980. So, you know, the only information that existed was on corporate art collections. There was a lot of information about that. So I just went about working intuitively. And then about 5 years later, I found other people who were doing the same thing across the nation. Duke had someone, and University of Connecticut Medical Center had one, and Iowa. So there was about six of us that we just sat down and decided we were going to create an organization, which became the Society for Arts and Healthcare, which is a story all on its own.
So you didn't invent that service, but you were very early as a pioneer. Mm-hmm. And when you launched aesthetics, in your mind, was it fully formed? Did you know what it would become? Or did you just say, it worked with the architect, let's see if we can do it again as a business?
As a matter of fact, the first name of aesthetics was the Aesthetics Collection. So I thought, okay, I'll put together 100 artists. And so with these 100 artists, we could, you know, answer any needs. And within 5 years, we evolved out of that, realizing that, you know, we really needed to produce intentional solutions, intentional design, and that meant, you know, going wherever we needed. The other thing that started to happen is I was getting projects outside of San Diego. And so we were working in Anaheim and then Los Angeles, and then we got some projects in the Midwest, and we realized that we needed to resource artists in those communities. And so, you know, the name changed from the Aesthetics Collection to Aesthetics, and the whole focus changed, you know, from representing artists, which is really where we started, to being a storyteller from the owner's point of view, so that we could use whatever tools we needed to start telling their stories of how they wanted to relate to the community. The physical environment of healthcare it's never neutral. And if you think about it, there really aren't neutral environments. If you look at all architecture, you know, either it's contributing to health and well-being or it's preventing health and well-being.
Yeah. You mentioned your storyteller process. Can you dive deeper into that? What does that process look like?
Well, today we call it the art of place. And what that is about is really understanding the community. So a great project we worked on, which is a good example, is in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. And so we met with the senior leadership and realized that the demographics, they were building a whole new campus in an area, understanding there was going to be a boom and growth, and that looking at the community, it was going to be very diverse. And so how do you create statements of welcome and belonging, a reflection of the community through the interiors? And so that's the type of story. So we then do a deep dive into the community and we start telling those stories with the art. For instance, Lancaster, you know, was one of the stops on the Underground Railroad, you know, and so we told that story. We looked into the African-American artists in the community and engaged them in telling their story.
That's fascinating. I love that idea. And so how is the artwork selected in terms of the type of art that you're going to use? Because there's, you know, sculptural art and there's painting and there's different types of art. How do you do that?
It's a very collaborative process. You know, I always say we co-design. We're not the decision makers. We bring a lot of choices before the healthcare institution. So we always start off with an art committee, and the art committee needs to be a real reflection of the community, both the institution in terms of administrative, clinical people, and perhaps we have emergency there, and then we have chaplain, but then we have art gallery owners and maybe museum people. So it's a reflection, you know, of that community. And we usually have 16, 18 people on that community. And people say, oh my God, how do you come up with consensus? And
yeah.
And it's really easy because you challenge them to really look at what is the emotional experience that you want your patients and families and staff to feel when they walk through those doors.
Yeah.
And so we start off with, they give me the words, you know, it's all their words, right? And then we create a series of goals, you know, from those words, you know, and we narrow it down to about 5 or 6 goals. And then we create a mission statement for the project and then a vision of where we're going to go with it, you know, in 10 years. And so that's a process that takes about 3 meetings to do. But what it does is it sets the groundwork of, what are we looking for? How do we make decisions? So that's the beginning.
Who is your client? Who's paying you? Right? Because I'm hearing this and I'm like, oh, that's wonderful. But depending on who's paying for it, you may get some pushback on some of what you're trying to accomplish with how long it takes and how much time you're putting into it. So how does that work?
In the earlier years of aesthetics, we put these together for a hospital or a medical office building, you know, so it wasn't very broad in terms of the representation. But the whole healthcare world has changed so much.
Yeah.
So hospitals are part of systems.
Yeah.
And it's really the systems that make the decisions. And so right now we market to systems. And they understand the importance of what needs to be standardized and what needs to be customized, right?
Yeah.
And so we help them with that from an art point of view, you know, what should be standardized and how do we make this custom? And so it makes a lot of sense because systems spend a lot of money on branding, on community relations.
Right. Yeah.
And when you look at, you know, what I charge, you know, compared to the cost of a building, right? You know, nothing costs under $300 million anymore. You know, that's a modest building, you know. So, you know, to charge a fee to do this is very modest compared to the challenges that they've had. And they've been in business long enough to know that a lot of hospitals or systems are patchwork quilts.
Right. Let's take a quick break to say thank you to our sponsors for their support of this episode. This episode of Entree Architect Podcast is sponsored by RCAT. If you've been listening to this podcast for any length of time, you've heard me talk about the importance of building systems that save time and reduce friction in your practice. That's exactly why I recommend RCAT. When I need product information or specifications, CAD details, BIM objects, or sustainability documentation, I don't want to hunt through dozens of manufacturer websites or fill out forms just to download a file. With ArtCat, I can find what I need fast, and everything is free to access. No subscription, no paywall. In fact, you don't even need to register with your email address. Just go to ArtCat.com, search for the product information you need, and get back to serving your clients. Thousands of architects use ArtCat every day because it simply makes work easier. Visit ArtCat.com and see why. That's ArtCat, ArtCat.com. It's interesting because I've experienced and I've noticed throughout my life how hospitals have changed. Hospitals used to be independent organizations, right? It was a medical center, and that was the business, was the medical center. Now, like you said, they're all becoming systems. And so there's multiple hospitals and multiple offices and multiple facilities that are all part of a bigger system. And you also see that the design of those buildings have significantly changed, and the customer experience has changed, that you can clearly see, you know, as a business guy and an architect, when I go to a hospital, it's like fantasy land for me, not for when I'm sick, but when I go into a hospital, I look at it as, you know, I look at the systems and I look at the processes that are there, but I also look at how the customer service works in a hospital. And over the years, that customer experience has become much better, right? That they recognize as a system that there's an ROI to that, or else they wouldn't be doing it, right? And so the customer experience is important. And so the way people are interacting with you has changed over the years. And the design of interiors in hospitals has changed with work like what you're doing. And so I can certainly understand why there is a need for what you do. But it's very interesting to understand that you started this in the 1980s. So you have been part of the evolution of this change. Has your client always been the hospital? Has it always been the system?
Yes. I'd say within the past 6 to 7 years, you know, as hospitals have consolidated into larger and larger systems, you know, our whole marketing approach is more to systems than individual facilities.
Is that easier or harder?
Harder.
Because you're now communicating with a system rather than a person.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
There's more relationship building that has to be done. You have to find the right people, right? Mm-hmm. Architects who are working in those industries also experience those same issues. You describe your work as whole person design. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yes. So we're really looking at this emotional experience and how this emotional experience can be mapped through the healthcare journey. One thing that we know is that people are very stressed, you know, whether it's their personal health or it's their family's health. And so, you know, as you move through the journey, you know, there's lots of pinpoints where we can modulate the experience. Of course, you know, parking, right? You know, just like, what do I do for parking,
right?
You know, and the journey from parking to the front door. And what is that welcoming experience like? How do you feel that? And then from there, it's getting to your destination, you know, so it's the combination of wayfinding, interiors, you know, and the art, you know, so it's, we try to work very collaboratively with the architects and the interior designers, because what we've learned from the field of neuroaesthetics is that the person who's navigating this journey is experiencing everything. You know, they're experiencing the light that's coming through and the amount of light, as well as the finishes and the color. There's, as you know, the wayfinding information and the signage. And so everything has to work together. So when we say whole person, we look at really what does the person need, where they are on their healthcare journey. You know, for instance, we spend a lot of time now in what we consider the clinical part of their experience. Formerly, people would spend money in the waiting rooms and the lobbies and maybe some corridors, and that's it.
Yeah.
But we really spend a lot of money where there is pain and suffering, you know, all the treatment spaces, the MRI spaces, you know, the CAT scan spaces, as well as the subwaiting spaces, the changing room spaces. So it's all those spaces. And not only the patient spaces, but the staff spaces. I would be remiss if I didn't talk about, you know, the big shift in the last 5 years to really look at the physician-nurse journey as well, you know, and how are we dealing with architecture, interior finishes, art, to have them feel respected.
Yeah.
I've done many surveys of the staff experience, and especially in older facilities, and have found it appalling.
Yeah.
You know, the concrete entry, you know, the poor lighting, you know, the staff lounges. I mean, we have a crisis today in physician and nurse burnout. And we know today that the environment and the whole environment can make a big difference.
Yeah, and that impacts the patients directly, right? If the staff is stressed and upset before they even get to the patients are impacted by that. Talking about the research versus the empathy and the intuition, how do you balance the research and evidence-based design with intuition and empathy or creative judgment?
Well, there's such a beautiful broad body of literature now to back up what, you know, I started doing 40 years ago intuitively. And so we definitely consider our work research-based. So, you know, we use the broad theories of biophilia, which we know we are just sort of tuned to relax when we're in a nature-based environment. So there's been a lot of research on biophilia, and not every piece of nature. I mean, you know, deserts or a landscape of a single tree without any leaves is not inspiring. You know, so there is a lot of research that has come out of neurosciences and psychology, and, you know, based on what we're doing, you know, if we're doing mental health or we're doing a burn unit, you know, we bring to the table the current research on that to try and help the decisions be made. So the research makes a really, really big difference today, you know, because what we have found is that the art, you know, can do a whole variety of different things. And so I'm just going to run by some of the research.
Sure.
You know, there's research on sense of place, place attachment theory, place identity theory, cultural landscape theory, creative placemaking. You know, just some that back up that when you are seeing imagery or feeling like an environment relates to the culture that you're living in, relates to the geography, that you feel more comfortable and have a deeper sense of belonging. So it's really great that there's, you know, so much research that can be brought to the table.
Yeah. And I would imagine that that's how it's translated into an actual arts program. You mentioned arts program at the very beginning, mm-hmm. versus just, you know, hanging artwork on the walls, right? There's a very big difference. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Again, I'm just going to tell you a little bit of what the science has told us, you know, that the right curation of art can help reduce stress and modulate the nervous system, reduce cortisol levels, activates the parasympathetic pathways. It activates reward and pleasure networks, improves emotional regulation and mental health. So there's a lot of information, you know, that we bring to the table about curating art as opposed to just buying and selling and hanging artwork. So there's a reason behind all of the selections.
Has it become standard practice now for healthcare, let's say hospitals, that this type of design is integrated into the architecture of these buildings, or is it still something that needs to be promoted and convince the owners that this is important?
So I would say that there's been enough written about and enough presentations that most hospitals know that the environment is really important and that architecture, interior design, and well-selected art is important. And the challenge that we see is that budgets are being cut. Mm-hmm. I'm sure the architects that we're listening to are hearing in almost every area, you know, budgets are being cut, and, you know, the profitability of the hospitals, 1-2%, you know, is good at this particular point. And so, you know, they're continuously looking at cutting the architecture, the interior design, and the art budget. And the art budget looks like something that is, you know, easy to cut, right?
Right. Exactly. When you're looking at it on a list of items, they're like, oh, art, gone.
Exactly. So we answer that by saying we help raise the money for the art. And so the last 10 years, almost all the projects that we work on are paid for by philanthropy. And what that does in working collaboratively with the architects is, you know, architects are very creative and they look at their building and they have a vision of how they'd like to see it complete. And in many ways, it has these enhancements, you know, both finish enhancements and art enhancements they would like to see happen here. And having them be cut because of budget is painful. So we go in there and say, okay, there are people who will be willing to pay for this. Actually, and they can pay for it at such a level that there's money left over to endow the program. And in all cases, we've been able to do that.
Wow.
Which really, you know, makes... It's a win-win situation for everyone. It's a win for the, yeah, the designers, right? The designers and the architects, the institutions. It's a win for the donor. I mean, I just came back from an opening for a project where we did a 5-story mural. You know, the architect designed it in a glass front, so it would be front-facing to the community. And when it's lit at night, it was sort of like a beacon. And so a family, a local family, underwrote this piece. And they were so excited at the opening. They were saying thank you to me, you know, because, you know, we helped facilitate this project. You know, so they get a lot out of it as well, the donors. And coming about it from that particular point of view, that we're giving them an opportunity of creating something fabulous, you know, is great.
Yeah. Is that philanthropy and that the fundraising part of what you're doing, is that part of your service? Is it just standard of part of what you do?
Collaborating with the foundations, yes.
Mm-hmm. Got it. So you coordinate that.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Yeah. Fascinating service that you provide. I didn't know that what you do existed. I always assumed that that was part of the interior design solutions in hospitals, but I'm glad that you're there. I'm glad that you're doing what you do. Looking back across the more 4 decades of doing this, is there a project or a personal experience that fundamentally changed the way you think and feel about the design that you do?
Well, we had the opportunity of working with Perkins and Will on an HGA on a very large program for Stanford. It was the Lucile Packard Children's Hospital. And the owner was smart enough to bring us in the beginning. And just when, you know, the concept design drawings were done, before DD. And we really sat down as a team and developed how we wanted art to be integrated into the building. So, you know, they had a terrazzo floor, but we found an incredible mosaic artist from England who did these wonderful inlays for the children, you know, in the floor, you know, of sea life. They created this amazing elevator shaft, which looked like a redwood tree. And we were able to carve into it area homes for the ambassador animals that were made out of bronze for each floor. And it went on and on and on and on. And yes, that really did change my thinking, because so much can be done, you know, when artists are brought to the table to work with the architects at the beginning of a project. And so my clients that have been long-term clients of mine understand that now. And so we get involved at the very beginning of the project. And so, yes.
Yeah, I love that. What do you wish more architects understood about the work that you do?
that it's designed to be collaborative and that what we bring to the table is a deep and broad toolbox. But, you know, we're not trying to change their design. We're really trying to help articulate the fine points of what they're trying to do.
Fascinating story. I love the work that you do. We're going to have our final question here. What's one thing that a small firm architect can do today to build a better business for tomorrow?
I think that if they can really bring intention, the strongest intention to every project, realizing that no matter how small the project is, that it really affects the whole human experience. And you just, you know, budgets can be cut, but just really getting the whole team to gather around that intentionality, because that's the core of, I think, in design.
Her name is Annette Ridenour, and the firm is Aesthetics Incorporated. You can learn more about what Annette does and how to work with her at aesthetics.net. You should go check that out and see all the amazing art. Thank you very much, Annette, for the work that you do. You are having an impact, especially with all the years that you've been doing it, a massive impact on the way hospitals are designed and expanded from there about how all architecture is designed with art in mind. And so I thank you for picking up that torch so many years ago and running with it and building the firm that you've built and helping millions of people feel better and live better through the architecture and the art that you have integrated into it. So thank you for that. And thank you for coming by here and sharing your knowledge and your stories at Entree Architect Podcast.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
If you enjoyed this episode of Entree Architect Podcast, please share a link with a friend, because that's how we've continued to grow and serve thousands more small firm architects just like you. Thank you to our sponsors for this episode. Links to the sponsors and all the resources we discussed today, they are all available in the show notes for this episode at entrearchitect.com/podcast. Entree Architect is a proud member of the Gable Media Network. It's the multimedia network moving the architecture, engineering, and construction industries forward through the power of storytelling. You can earn AIA continuing education credits by listening to select episodes of this podcast and many others at gablemedia.com/members. And if you are a small firm architect, listen up. Join us today at Entree Architect Network. It's the worldwide community for entrepreneur architects. We've been around since 2012, and our basic level is now free to join. Yes, you can join Entree Architect Network for free. And that gives you access to valuable business resources and our global community of architects. And you can upgrade anytime for live coaching, AIA approved training, and mastermind support. So visit entrearchitect.com to learn more and to get started. My name is Mark R. LePage. Thank you for listening to the Entree Architect Podcast. Love, learn, share.
I've mentioned it to my family, but in terms of telling people like, oh yeah, we're doing this, I'm looking for projects, you got anything? Yeah. I'm not there yet because it scares the shit out of me.
Dreaming of launching your own architecture firm? Well, buckle up for a wild ride with Emerging, the podcast that shares what it's really like to start an architecture firm.
Where do we begin? We don't even know what type of business to formalize as. Is it an LLC? Is it an LLP? Like, how are taxes? I mean, the list is astronomical.
Season 1 featured founders Jeffrey, Lexi, and Chris, owners of Level Studio Architecture, are your fearless guides on this unfiltered journey from napkin sketches to a thriving studio.
One evening, stumbled into one last dive, we sat at the bar and pondered our postgraduate futures. Amidst the conversation, a napkin became the canvas for our aspirations, sketching plans and milestones, sealing our heartfelt commitment and shared dreams.
In drawing down dreams on a napkin collectively, that then, you know, in your head, you've rooted like, oh, I'm connected to these people, like long term.
The process of starting an architecture practice brims with excitement and challenges. demanding meticulous planning, flawless execution, and unyielding resilience.
I kind of hate the term because it's so overly used, but I think everybody knows imposter syndrome. And I think it's so real to this day. I don't know if it's with everybody, but with me, I'm always questioning, like, us, can we do this? Are we ready to do this? Are we prepared? Can we do it?
Did we just decide a name?
We did it, guys.
Oh my
one that
God.
Came out of nowhere.
Woo! It came out of nowhere. I liked it. I saw it.
Ready to turn your aspirations into reality? Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Emerging and chart your own path to architectural success.